I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon, the 20th of August. This hour, we're going to be talking about Egypt. News today is that Egypt's military-backed authorities did arrest the supreme leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mohamed Badi was arrested in an apartment close to the location of the six-week sit-in protest by supporters of Morsi. And last week, the encampment was cleared by security forces in a raid that killed hundreds of people. There's a good deal of news today about the news that is coming from Egypt. The new government is putting quite a bit of pressure on the only remaining news outlets in Egypt covering criticism of the violence, the foreign news media, Egyptian TV networks that supported Mohamed Morsi. On the night the general ousted him, authorities have raided and shut down the pan-Arab Al Jazeera network. They've taken steps to deny its Egyptian license and on Sunday arrested a correspondent. So there's been public scolding and arrests, and people who work for the foreign press have been detained. This because they're not giving the news the way the military in charge would like to give the news. There's also some report that perhaps we have cut off military aid. Americans have cut it off, and we'll talk about that. And we'll look a little bit at the history of U.S. relations with Egypt. Our guest this hour is Professor Jason Brownlee, Associate Professor of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas. His latest book is Democracy Prevention, The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance. And it looks at why, since 1973, the U.S. has helped reproduce authoritarianism in Egypt. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jason. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Jason Brownlee, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Yeah. Our phone line is a little, are you close to your phone? It's just a little distant.
Oh, okay.
There we go. That's much, much better. Thanks very much. Let's start with today's news, please. Senior government officials have evidently arrested the supreme leader of the country's Muslim Brotherhood, the spiritual guide, and they're talking about making this deemed a terrorist group and outlawing the group. What does this do to the already pretty tense and violent situation in Egypt? Was it a wise move to arrest the leader of the Brotherhood?
Well, I think what that arrest symbolizes is it's one more piece in an ongoing campaign of repression against the Brotherhood, which is threatening to put them back in the position they were in under Mubarak. Potentially, the Brotherhood could be outlawed and could really be pushed to the margins of Egyptian politics. So I would see the arrest of Mohamed Badia, along with the upcoming trial of another Muslim Brotherhood leader and the continuing detention of Mohamed Morsi, as all part of this campaign.
Mm-hmm. Is it something that's viable? Can you have an Egypt without a Muslim Brotherhood? It seems to me as though they've been in existence and a fairly potent force for a long period of time. Can you just say, well, they're outlawed and they go away?
Well, it depends on how you expect to govern. But if you're not going to govern with constant repression, then it's difficult to see how you could have a healthy state of politics without including the Muslim Brotherhood. I think right now one of the problems is that after the July 3rd coup, the military did not move to a process of national reconciliation that would include all parties, and instead they just upended the political system so that the Muslim Brotherhood, which was previously in power, is now basically without any power except what they can muster in the streets.
Tell me a little bit more about the military, who these people are, whether or not they have any intentions of having elections down the road.
Yeah, well, this is a new generation of military officers. Actually, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who's running the country, was appointed by the last president, Mohamed Morsi. He was appointed by the guy that he later deposed. And Sisi replaced the prior Minister of Defense, Tantawi. And so he is you have a kind of younger cohort of generals. But in terms of their plans for the country and whether they'll move it in a democratic direction, I would say that in formal terms, they do have a roadmap that includes a constitution, which will be put up for a popular vote, and then elections for the legislature and then for the presidency. But, you know, we had a lot of that kind of voting back in the Mubarak era. Authoritarian regimes these days tend to have voting and elections. So I would say that in formal terms, yeah, there are elections coming up, but the general appears to be actually positioning himself for a potential presidential run, either him or someone else from the military. So at this point, we're looking at the possibility of really a return to the kinds of authoritarianism that people thought they had gotten rid of in 2011.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about him. Do you know about his background? Has he appeared from nowhere, or who is he?
Well, I mean, he rose up in the military, but he's from a generation that was subsequent to the 1973 war, which was the last major war that Egypt fought. That was the war with Israel. And so he comes from a very different background than his predecessors. What we know of him so far suggests that he's also less enamored with the United States than the prior generation. I mean, Hosni Mubarak was a kind of envoy to the United States under Anwar Sadat, and other generations of other generals of Mubarak's generation had a very fond view of the U.S. There's some reporting that suggests Sisi's view of the United States has been colored by the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq and the broader kind of U.S. war on terrorism, which has tended to put the United States and many Muslim countries in an adversarial relationship. And so I think we see some of that coming out, some of the fact that he's less enamored with the United States coming out in his interactions with Secretary of Defense Hagel, which were regular for a time, but now appear to have been kind of put on pause, and in his general attitude towards advice coming from Washington.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to spend just a moment, simply because it's we're in the press, and it's amazing to me what's happened with the press, with the foreign news media. The New York Times is reporting today that General El-Sisi is putting concerted pressure on the only remaining news outlets in Egypt covering criticism of the violence, and that's the foreign news media. And we've seen some arrests and some detentions of foreign news. Military had already shut down Egyptian TV networks that supported President Mohamed Morsi on the night the general ousted him. This is never a good sign when you're hopeful that a democracy will emerge when you're getting rid of the press.
That's right, and we've actually seen these types of actions earlier on in the transition when Tantawi and the military were in charge in 2011. They really used the media, especially the main public or national television station, to turn people, to turn sort of the Egyptian public against the opposition. And I think we see that happening right now. Assisi is riding an initial wave of popular support following the July 3rd coup, which many Egyptians embraced. And I think he wants to keep that up, and he's going to do it not by sort of making a strong argument for why he's going to run the country effectively, but instead by suppressing alternate views.
And is he still riding a fairly high level of popular support?
Yeah, the indications are that the coup and even the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood is supported by a lot of Egyptians. I mean, I kind of say that with a sigh because it's sort of surprising to me that things have kind of capsized to this extent, that you had the opposition figures from the liberal and secular camps that were really facing some repression under Morsi are now embracing repression when it's directed against the Muslim Brotherhood. And one example of this, a kind of key liberal luminary who's spoken out in favor of what the military is doing, is the novelist Alaa Al-Aswani, who many of your listeners may know from his works, The Yacoubian Building in Chicago, which were translated into English and enjoyed a lot of success abroad. Alaa Al-Aswani has said that the Brotherhood was taking over, and so basically any kind of crackdown or repression against them at this point is justified. So you do actually, maybe surprising to me and maybe to some of your listeners, you do actually have some popular support for what is basically a junta taking charge after Egypt's first democratically elected president had been in power for 1 year.
I remember doing a show not very long ago on the Muslim Brotherhood and asking the question, is this a group to be worried about? What is the philosophy, et cetera? And I remember interviewing several people who said that basically they're providing services for people who are disenfranchised, for people who are poor. Now all of a sudden the government or the military is saying this is a terrorist organization. I guess it leads one to wonder, who are they and what is their philosophy? Is everybody overstating their own case?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the way to look at the Muslim Brotherhood is just to divorce ourselves from any kind of romantic notions about their operation and any kind of overly sinister notions about their operations. They're a political organization. Historically, they've been a very pragmatic organization. They've been willing to work with authoritarian leaders like Sadat and Hosni Mubarak. They were not taking part in the waves of violence against the government in the late 1970s and early 80s, and also again in the 1990s. And in fact, during the 1990s, they repeatedly tried to broker ceasefires between the Islamist insurgents and the Mubarak regime, and the Mubarak regime rejected those overtures. So they have historically not been what you would call a terrorist organization. The State Department does not designate them as such. So I think the Sisi and the current military leadership in Egypt is really trying to is really exaggerating their case when they try to play the terrorism card against the Muslim Brotherhood. At the same time, during the past year, the Muslim Brotherhood, and especially Mohamed Morsi, behaved in an increasingly autocratic manner toward their opponents. And I don't think the problem was that they were an Islamic organization. I think the problem was that they were an organization that had taken the presidency when there were not other institutions in place, like a strong parliament, other institutions that could counterbalance the presidency. Mm. And I think that temptation toward monopolizing power can be true of any movement if it comes into office without a kind of political structure in place that's going to ensure that the opposition has a voice.
Hmm. Well, it seems as though when you say autocratic rule, it seems as though that's been going on in Egypt for quite some time now. I'm trying to ask, trying to think, and maybe you can provide an answer. Was there a time when things were pretty peaceful and everybody's opinions were carefully considered and there was not autocratic rule?
Well, since the 1952 coup that overthrew the monarchy and subsequently got rid of the British, Egypt was ruled for nearly 60 years by military dictators, mainly Nasser, and then Sadat, and then Mubarak. And then Mubarak was ousted on February 11th of 2011. Prior to 1952, Egypt, for about 70 years, had been under some form of British control or indirect colonial control. There was a stretch, people would point to the 1920s as a liberal period in Egyptian politics, where there was a flourishing of political parties that had a strong popular base. There was a vigorous parliamentary life. And so in terms of precedents for a more democratic period, I think people would have to look that far back, which is basically looking 90 years ago.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Also, there is news, although it's sort of hard to decipher what the truth is here, that some reports are saying U.S. military aid to Egypt has been suspended. Others are saying pretty loudly it should be suspended. Others are saying no, it shouldn't. We'll ask Professor Jason Brownlee how that figures into the whole picture here. We're talking about Egypt and all that's going on in that country. This hour of the program, Professor Jason Brownlee is Associate Professor of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas, author of Democracy Prevention, The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Jason Brownlee. 800-486-8655 is the number. Hugh in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. The Muslim Brotherhood, to get an idea of their ideology, during World War II, their hopes were on General Rommel and the Nazis. They were all set to go in with him the minute he conquered Egypt. He failed, and of course they failed for a time. When they got to power, you see what happens when they get to power. The persecution of Christians, the burning of Christian churches, the killing of Christians, the demand for the destruction of Israel. The leading Brotherhood figures are openly calling Jews pigs and monkeys and so forth, and they had to destroy Israel. This is their whole notion, to kill the Jews, to kill the Christians. This is the ideal of these jihadists, of these Muslim fanatics. And they are in power, and they've been in power, and they've been torturing people who disagreed with them. Thank God the army has taken control. The advice, thank God they don't listen to Obama and his pro-Muslim advisors. Hillary's, one of her good friends is Huma Wiener, and she has connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, the Wiener fame of New York. That woman is connected to the Muslim Brotherhood. The advice they're getting include the Muslim Brotherhood. Why not include the Nazis in the party? You know, I mean, that's the notion of democracy that the Obama crowd is espousing.
Professor Brownlee.
I didn't hear a question, but I mean, I want to pick up on one point that the caller made, which is about the Muslim Brotherhood's anti-Semitic rhetoric. Which is, it's an interesting to note, I think significant to note, that Mohamed Morsi, and you can find this on YouTube, did call Jews like bloodsuckers and descendants of pigs and monkeys. John Stewart rightly satirized the piece on The Daily Show. And that was a couple of years before the uprising. It was around 2010. You can definitely find those remarks. He also called for war on Israel and saying the only way to liberate Palestinian lands is through violent conflict. What's interesting is to contrast that rhetoric, which you can definitely find from the Muslim Brotherhood before they came to power, with their policies in power. And one of the reasons why I think the Obama administration did find itself probably more accepting of the Muslim Brotherhood's policies than it might have expected at the outset was that the Muslim Brotherhood under Morsi was very willing to continue Mubarak's foreign policies toward Israel. So to continue the embargo on Gaza, to continue destroying the tunnels that help smuggle goods into Gaza. And so in many ways, Morsi, while rhetorically years earlier had been very hostile to Israel, in practice, when he came to power, he was very supportive of Israeli security needs and very willing to maintain the security cooperation between Israel and Egypt. And I think this goes to show how the Muslim Brotherhood is actually, I think contrary to some of the implications of the caller's remarks, has been incredibly pragmatic and prudential, and in that sense, very much a conventional political organization in the way that they operate.
Hmm. Israel must be more than a little concerned about security at this moment.
Yeah, reports are that both the Israelis and the Saudis, in terms of Israeli officials and Saudi officials, are very supportive of the Sisi taking over, very supportive of the military regaining control in Egypt. And certainly the Israelis can see in Assisi someone that they will be happy to work with. They have a history of intelligence cooperation, which Assisi was involved in. And so he's a man who's familiar to the Israeli government.
Hugh, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Mohammed in Milwaukee. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi there. My comment, and I would like to have a follow-up, I mean, is that you have to pick the Egyptian case as unisolated from what is going on right now in the Arabic world and in the Muslim world. We have been going through what's called the Arabic Spring, which basically is the jittering of a whole million of people against ongoing dictators. All these dictators are all the time supported and linked to Western superpower. And what happened in Egypt, the revolt against that, and the Muslim Brotherhood, they came along and they supported the aspiration of people, but the people of Egypt, and I'm one of them, has not seen any changes. He reiterated the old treaties with the Israeli state. He went ahead and confirmed the International Monetary Fund, which has brought Egypt into slavery. So we were disenfranchised and disillusioned by someone who promised change. I think the real change that the Ummah of Muslims, and the Arab including, is to bring back their unity as one state, one super state, that is the Khilafah state, the caliphate, and that is the only way out. And to say that there are Christians, that there are non-Muslims, where these will not be respected, this is out wrong, because Islam has ruled while the Christians are there, and they have enjoyed the biggest ever historic tolerance and support.
Professor Brownlee, what is the way out? What is the way for peace?
Well, I don't know if I could propose one way out right now, but just to respond to what the caller was describing in terms of the creation of a caliphate, I mean, certainly that idea is circulating. I don't see that idea being put forward by a lot of parties in Egypt, even the Islamist parties like the Brotherhood or the more traditionalist Nur party in Egypt have tended to focus more at the level of the nation state. That idea of a sort of broader Islamic nation and bringing countries together across their juridical borders is certainly circulates, but it has not resonated as a major feature of candidates and political parties during the Egyptian transition, at least not so far. Now, both callers have mentioned sort of the rights and the safety of Christians in Egypt, mm-hmm. and I think that's an important point to address. Historically, the position of Christians in Egypt, Christians constitute somewhere between 7 to 10% of the population of Egypt, and they are the largest population of Christians in the Middle East is found inside of Egypt. And historically, the safety of Christians and their economic prosperity has sort of risen and fallen as the country's national fortunes have risen and fallen. And so, right now, as Egypt descends into a very serious and violent crisis, we see Christians being some of the foremost victims of that violence, and churches being burned, and Christian religious figures being targeted, and so I think that is definitely a concern. I would a little bit disagree with what the last caller Muhammad was saying about how Christians could necessarily be incorporated into a caliphate. At least in terms of Egyptian Christians with whom I've spoken, they would have concerns that any type of sort of a caliphate or traditional Islamic political system would relegate them to a second-class status where they might have some formal rights, but they would not be able to hold positions of executive authority like being the head of a university or the governor of a state or even or the president of the country. So I think there's very much a debate going on about the guaranteeing individual rights, especially rights of Christians and other potentially vulnerable populations, in a system that is sort of harking back to older Islamic, older religious mm-hmm. traditions.
Mm-hmm. Muhammad, you had another question or comment?
Yeah, I have a quick comment. Thank you for allowing me that opportunity. That's great. Well, in terms of the second status, no, I'm here as a Muslim, and I cannot be as a Muslim who believe in the Constitution of Islam, which is totally different from the Constitution of the United States, to be a president of the United States. I'm not allowed to do that. I have to relinquish my belief as a free enterprise and democracy in order for me to be allowed even to run for election. That is the same status for the Christian. Yet I enjoy a lot of rights. That's the same situation as far as Christian is concerned. And many of the leaders of the Christian, they are now calling for the caliphate because they realize that either a caliphate or a puppet state, like the status of Egypt right now, it is nothing but a puppet of the United States and the International Monetary Fund. In terms of Israel's status, now Israel is a state that is based on the apartheid, the superiority of the Jewish people over Muslims. That is never going to sell to the Muslim world. It is going to be revamped. Not only Israel will disappear, but also all these 50 states that will call them self-states. They are not any entities. They all will be converged and fused in one single superpower that's called the Caliph state. And that's how peace is going to be brought to the area.
Professor Brownlee.
Maybe we have a point of agreement regarding how Christians would fare under an Islamic state in the sense that they, whereas a Muslim U.S. citizen can certainly be president according to law, according to some interpretations of the Islamic tradition, and Copts, that is Egyptian Christians, are not allowed to hold positions of executive authority where they have some type of basically authority over Muslims. And I've discussed this at length with members of Islamic parties inside of Egypt, and I think the caller is in agreement with that point. And what I'm trying to say is that for Copts, for Egyptian Christians, many of whom I've spoken with, that is a concern. That, you know, if you're basically saying a Copt couldn't be a governor, a Copt couldn't be the dean of a university, a Copt couldn't be president, that is not political equality as they see it, and that's not the kind of system they want to live under.
Mohammed, thanks very much for the call. Lines are open right now. We're talking about all that's going on in Egypt, and it's a great deal. Professor Jason Brownlee is our guest this hour, Associate Professor of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We've been through so many shows on Egypt, and one moment, this great hope for democracy and cheering in the squares and great jubilation. And then we went to something else, and now we're somewhere else. It's just been quite an upheaval. But this is a particularly dangerous time. And so we're looking at why it is happening and what's the way out with our guest. We also have calls, as you know, in the United States for a suspension of U.S. aid to Egypt, military aid, which is over $1 billion a year. Would you agree with that or not? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Let's talk about the extent of violence and the amount of violence. 1,000 Morsi supporters, at least, killed in the streets since last Wednesday, which is not very long ago. There have been some human rights activists in Egypt who have criticized this particular government or the military for a disproportionate amount of violence since Sisi's takeover on the 3rd of July. Would you agree with that description of it? It's disproportionate violence?
Yeah, yes, it is clearly disproportionate in the sense that you do not have equal sides in terms of, there's not equality in terms of the use of violence by both sides, and the casualty figures show that, whereas I think dozens of police have been killed, you have hundreds, if not over 1,000 at this point, of demonstrators being killed. And this is a kind of violence and a level of violence that Egypt did not witness in the Mubarak era. So under 30 years of Mubarak, there was never this kind of series of massacres that we've gotten in July and August of this year.
So why this kind of disproportionate violence? What's behind it?
The military, especially General Sisi, is trying to take charge, and at the same time, basically by cracking down and forcing their most vocal opponents in the Muslim Brotherhood to return to their homes and leave the streets. And at the same time, you had a Muslim Brotherhood organization which was unwilling to back down quickly and ready to stay in the streets even in the face of police and military brutality. So it was a combination, but the main driver here is the military's willingness to use force.
I was reading some article today that said that it recalled the years of the early 50s when Abdel Nasser consolidated his power by cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood. What did he do?
Yeah, well, so what Nasser did, there are a number of parallels with the current period. And one of them is that Nasser, for a while, worked with the Muslim Brotherhood and was on good relations with them. But then when he had basically removed the other opposition movements, he turned on the Muslim Brotherhood and engaged in a campaign of outright repression and forced them to go underground. And I think something to bear in mind is that the consequence of that campaign of repression and that crackdown was the emergence of Brotherhood figures who embraced violence, who previously might not have embraced violence, but because they were driven underground by Nasser's repression, they turned to violence. And I think that it is a concern of the present period, that Sisi's crackdown, while bringing some type of stability through repression in the short term, may sow the seeds of new terrorist movements over the medium and long term.
Mm. And there's been some discussion about whether or not all of these people who have been protesting and all who have been killed have been members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Are there a great number of opposition groups, and would some of those be more rightfully classified as terrorist organizations who have been in opposition?
Right now, in terms of the people who are on the streets, it's mainly Muslim Brotherhood supporters. I don't know of any of them who would belong to a terrorist organization as designated by the State Department. I mean, there's one group in Egypt, Al-Jamaa al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group, which remains on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. But I'm not sure if they've had a significant presence in the protests. My impression is that they have not.
Listening to the NPR news at the top of the hour, I was doing something else, but I was catching just a couple words here and there. What's the latest on suspension of U.S. military aid to Egypt? I guess there have been reports today that it's already happened, and then reports that it hasn't, and then reports that people don't really know. Do you know?
Yeah. Well, I think what it appears that the White House and State Department are trying to retain the maximum flexibility that they can with the aid while making sure that they're following the law. There is a law that says if you have a coup of a democratically elected government, then aid needs to be suspended. And so the White House's approach to that restriction was to not designate the July 3rd takeover by Sisi as a coup. But it appears that behind the scenes, in terms of their approach to aid, the White House and the State Department may be acting as if such a cutoff could take place. And so they may withhold some military aid or hold up some economic aid until they can make sure that it could be delivered within the constraints of the law. So far, though, there's no evidence of an intention or a desire by the White House or the State Department to suspend military aid or economic aid. And definitely a suspension of military aid has been called for by several prominent senators, including John McCain of Arizona and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And that has been done in the past. When you have not just a coup, but if you have significant human rights violations, there are laws that say, most particularly the Leahy Law, named after Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, that says the U.S. should stop providing aid and arms to to a government that has committed those human rights violations until the president certifies that the human rights situation has improved.
Hmm.
And the U.S. took actions along these lines in the 1990s against Indonesia in response to a massacre of over 250 civilians in 1991. And so you had asked earlier kind of what do I see as the path out, and although I don't know what the path out of this crisis will be for Egypt overall, I do think a useful step for the United States government to take would be to impose an embargo on U.S. arms and U.S. training going to both the Egyptian military and the Egyptian police until the human rights situation has definitely improved and until there's a meaningful political transition that is being led by civilians and not by the military.
Hmm. And yet it's something that's so much a part of what I call the military-industrialized complex. I was watching CBS last night, and they had a story about this town, which is doing very well, thank you, because the main thing, American town, they're making tanks for Egypt, and they're making lots and lots of great big tanks for Egypt, very expensive, and they're being shipped over there. And according to the report, nobody's using them. They're just going to Egypt, and they're sitting there. They're kind of a showpiece for the military. And you think, holy Toledo, that's kind of something that you're spending all this time building something to go to a country where they're not even using it. So what's going on in Egypt is also tied into the American economy and jobs in some way, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. A lot of the aid program can be seen as a jobs program for U.S. industries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that means necessarily, though, that the aid program should be continued out of kind of inertia. I think that one could, if one were not giving the aid to Egypt to buy those tanks, you could look at usefully putting that money back into the American economy to shift those industries over into something that would be more productive and more useful all around in the long term. But yeah, absolutely, you've pointed to one of the linkages that keeps the aid going.
Yeah. We are going to continue our conversation with Professor Jason Brownlee. He's Associate Professor of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas. Latest book is Democracy Prevention, The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance, which looks at why since 1973 the U.S. has helped reproduce authoritarianism in Egypt. We have many ways that you can reach us. We have a lot on the table here. What do you make of what happened, the General Sisi's takeover on July 3rd. You, of course, have seen pictures of the horrendous violence in Egypt since last Wednesday. The number of Muslim Brotherhood Morsi supporters who have been killed, disproportionate violence, many are saying, although those who used to be providing critical analysis of the Morsi administration now have had their invitations drying up since they are criticizing the police's disproportionate violence since the takeover on July 3rd. So we can talk about the history of all of this, of Egypt, and what the hopes are for that country in terms of what the Egyptian people want and what might be the best outcome in terms of peace for the world. U.S. aid to Egypt. There have been calls, as you know, for a suspension of U.S. aid to Egypt because of the coup that took place and how the administration has responded to that, getting around calling it a coup. What do you make of all of this? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always reach us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Professor Brownlee, and let's go to Eric in Madison next. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I've really enjoyed the segment today, and I just had a two-part question that hasn't really been discussed, mainly relating to the economic implications for regional trade, and with that, the ongoing geopolitical ramifications throughout the region. I'll take my response off there.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so the economic implications for regional trade, right now Egypt is not doing a lot of trading. The Egyptian economy is suffering. Already Egyptian exports were not strong to begin with. So, and in fact, Egypt's largest trading partner is the United States. So there's already a problem of kind of the lack of interconnectedness among Middle Eastern states and in terms of trading within the region. And then the second part of the question, Kathleen, I don't know if you caught it, about
the implications for the rest of the region?
For the rest of the region, yeah. I think the implications are that if you see a restoration of authoritarianism in Egypt, which was one of the exemplars of the Arab Spring, this is really going to dash hopes for other opposition movements, other peaceful protesters that might have hoped to replace dictatorships with democracies. And at that, you know, if Egypt goes back to authoritarianism, really the only strong democratic experiment that you could still point to would be in Tunisia and the center of North Africa, and which is a much smaller country and regionally a less influential country than Egypt. I think what happens in Egypt is going to be a demonstration case for the rest of the region.
Well, what in the world happened so rapidly? I remember all the joy in the streets in Tahrir Square not that long ago.
Yes, absolutely. There was euphoria at the beginning of 2011 after Mubarak was swept from power. But within months, that actually turned into disappointment as Islamists who had been on the sidelines for much of the uprising moved to the vanguard of the transition and with the first voting that took place, and then also the military took charge. So you have a roller coaster of ups and downs for the opposition groups that were in the driver's seat in the original 18-day uprising, and now those groups. Some of them were happy about the coup against Morsi, but I fear that over the next few months they're going to find themselves marginalized as well as this general and his entourage take over.
Eric, thanks for the call. Adam in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a comment for you and a question. My comment is regarding the statement from your guest saying that Muslim Brotherhood never been or not associated with violence, and I disagree with this. Someone who lived in Egypt and now living in the United States, definitely, they've been engaged in violence against the society since they started from the 30s and 40s until Nasser time and even these days. So that's a big issue with the Egyptian people that they don't like. That you are calling for democracy one day, and the second day, if you don't, if you are voted out or if you are not in power by any means, now you raise arms against the people. And the commons in the streets, they don't like this. My question now is, your guest, is if he can shed some light on what's going on in Sinai Peninsula now, and who's killing all of these soldiers. Every other day, you wake up on a... And 25 or 30 people killed from the soldiers, basically slaughtered. They usually take soldiers that they are finished their service or they are doing their daily routines or doing something not really, don't have their weapons, and some groups attack them and slaughter them or kill them with RPG or any of this kind of weapons. This is something that the West is not talking about the burning of churches throughout Egypt. And we really, Egyptian people's voices need to be heard, not just the Brotherhood.
All right. And stay with us, if you would, Adam. I wanted to ask you a question. Professor Brownlee.
Yes. I want to get to both points. I guess we'll start with the Sinai. The Sinai has been racked by violence for years, at least a decade, really, where you've had militant organizations attacking the police, and soldiers in the Sinai. The Sinai, by the way, is, especially Northern Sinai, is a heavily militarized region. It has never been kind of properly developed in terms of socioeconomic terms. And so if militants are looking to attack soldiers,
that's an area where they can find many targets. So that's definitely going on. I do think the media are covering it. Definitely the attack that the caller referred to, where 24 soldiers were killed, was discussed yesterday in the context of a prior killing of Muslim Brotherhood detainees who were in prison or being transferred between prisons. So that's definitely happening. In terms of the Muslim Brotherhood's history of violence, I don't think I said that they never engaged in violence, but they are not a State Department designated terrorist organization. And in turn, with respect to the period of British colonial rule before 1952, the caller is absolutely right that the Brotherhood did use violence. They had an armed wing. They engaged in assassinations. But what's important to recall is that the other parties, the secular parties, were doing the same thing, and secular parties also had armed wings. This was all in the context of fighting the British while struggling for political power inside of Egypt. And mm-hmm. So I think that does need to be taken into account.
Yeah. As someone who is from Egypt, Adam, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about what could lessen the violence right now, what could move Egypt toward a place where people are happier and safer.
If you asked me before, I would, like a couple of weeks ago, I would say so many solutions, but now it's really chaos, and I really don't know what's going on. It seems like people lost their mind there, and cool heads is not prevailing. And I hope that the United States exert their effort and their connections with the Muslim Brotherhood to basically cool things down and ask them to just join the roadmap for democracy and move forward. There is an election, and it could be every time they use violence, they basically reduce their chances for being involved or integrated into the society again. And I have to tell you, a lot of people, Egyptian different groups, they started to dislike them more and more. The more they raise arms, the more they cause trouble to the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to go back to make a smaller comment about your guest answers here. One of the things that you said that the Muslims who were fighting the British, that's true, but also the people that they assassinated, they were part of the Egyptian elite. They're ruling the Egyptian, and they're trying to advance the cause. So they were not directly only to the British, but also to the Egyptian. And also the other thing about the Sinai Peninsula, the Sinai Peninsula been silent for almost a year, except for this one big incident happened after Morsi took over. And Morsi took this as a chance to remove the military leadership. But then they said for 1 year, nothing going on. And then they started back after Morsi was ousted. It seems like the Muslim Brotherhood policy is basically having a wing doing all of the politics and all of the elections and voting and peaceful demonstration, but also they have some affiliated groups. I'm not saying this as part of the Muslim Brotherhood, but maybe affiliated groups that they do the dirty work for them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Adam, for your call.
I would just, Kathleen, if
yeah,
I may,
of course.
I just want to point out that during Morsi's presidency, there was never a massacre like what we've seen the past mm-hmm. 2 months. Repeated massacres where we and not just of and it's not just Egyptians who have been targeted. We know this from foreign journalists who have also been shot at and have told us about that. So we just need to be clear about the kind of violence and the fact that the overwhelming majority of the victims of the violence have been unarmed civilians, and the overwhelming perpetrators of the violence to date in terms of these major massacres have been agents of the state, either police or soldiers, who are armed.
And that's only going to make more of the relatives and the friends and people who were members of the Muslim Brotherhood angrier, right? I mean, this could all just keep escalating, right?
Yes, I think what Adam referred to in terms of fringe elements is important to keep in mind. And a lot of the people are just going to end up being angry and frustrated, and they'll just stay that way. But then a very small minority on the edge of the movement could split off mm-hmm. and then could start planning some type of violent retaliation. And I think that's what everyone should want to avoid.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Our guest this hour, Professor Jason Brownlee. He's Associate Professor of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas. He has a book, Democracy Prevention, The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We didn't get to all of your messages, but thank you. They are noted, and we'll be on this topic again sometime soon, I am sure. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio. Those of you who have been involved in the foster care system or would like to learn about it, and I assume that's everybody, stay tuned. Interesting hour ahead.